Good morning. Welcome to this news conference sponsored by the Vermont Law School Institute for Energy and the Environment. You'll be hearing from two speakers today, and before we introduce them as a group and then individually, I wanted to go ahead and invite the operator on the line to explain how the Q&A period is going to work.
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star and then 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you would like to remove yourself from the queue, you may press star and then 2. Again, it is star and then 1 to ask a question.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to have the operator back on the line at the start of the Q&A period to repeat those instructions about how members of the news media can pose questions. As I mentioned, you're going to be hearing from two speakers today, Mark Cooper, Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and the Environment, Vermont Law School, and report author, Public Risk, Private Profit, Ratepayer Cost, Utility Imprudence, and Peter A. Bradford, the adjunct professor at the Vermont Law School, a former member of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and a former Utility Commission chair in New York and Maine. Let's go ahead and let's begin with our first speaker.
Thanks, Will. This is Mark Cooper. The eulogies for nuclear renaissance are mounting in headlines across the general trade and financial media. But it's important to probe behind the headlines to have a clear understanding of this remarkable turn of events and to draw the right lessons from it. In summarizing the lengthy analysis of the demise of the nuclear renaissance I am releasing today, I want to emphasize 3 points. First, the primary cause of the collapse of the nuclear renaissance lies in the fundamental nature of nuclear technology. Reactors simply cannot be built at a cost that makes nuclear power competitive with the alternatives available. As a result, utilities must demand massive subsidies from ratepayers, which is my second point. The billions of dollars of economic pain in terms of excess costs that building new reactors is imposing and will impose on the ratepayers and economies of the states that have pursued construction of reactors has been caused by a foolish decision to repeal the fundamental principles of consumer protection that have governed the delivery of utility electricity services for a century. Third, the most basic rule of economic analysis and competitive market behavior is that all decisions are forward-looking. You must not allow sunk costs to distort future choices. When should you walk away from $1 billion or $2 billion of sunk costs? When continuing down the wrong path will waste $5 or $10 billion more. This is hard to do, but prudent economic decisions require that we not throw good money after bad. As I show in the analysis, natural gas certainly played an important factor in the demise of the nuclear renaissance, and declining demand played a role too. But the most important, the root cause of the death of the nuclear renaissance was the inability of the industry to deliver on the hope and hype that it could build new reactors at a reasonable cost. If you look back at the beginning of the nuclear renaissance PR hype cycle in 2001 and 2003, we find that 36 estimates put forward claimed that new reactors could be built for an overnight cost of about $2,000 per kilowatt. That's the capital cost without financing. In the past 2 years, utilities and nuclear enthusiasts have put out about a dozen estimates that put the cost at about $5,000 per kilowatt, and independent analysts on Wall Street put the number closer to $7,000. The tripling of costs is what killed the nuclear renaissance. Given that building new reactors is uneconomic, how is it that even a few are under construction? All of the reactors being built today are in states that shifted nuclear construction cost risks onto the shoulders of ratepayers. Ironically, 3/4 of the reactors that were proposed during the nuclear renaissance were proposed in states that did not have advanced cost recovery. Not one of those reactor projects is moving forward. In contrast, every one of the reactor construction projects that entered into an engineering, procurement, and construction contract is in a state that has advanced cost recovery. This is as pure a natural experiment as we ever see. Advanced cost recovery is a necessary and close to a sufficient condition for nuclear reactor construction. The handful of utilities that rushed to sign contracts to build new reactors did not do so because they thought they had an economically attractive product. They did so because they were given a sweetheart deal by their state legislatures that shifted all of the risk of nuclear reactor construction onto ratepayers, while guaranteeing the utility advanced cost recovery and a huge increase in profit by adding a massive amount to the rate base. Given the reality on the ground today, the excess of costs that advanced cost recovery will impose on ratepayers in those states is likely to be in the range of $10 billion per project. That is discounted, deflated net present value over the next 40 years. Even if national policymakers impose a cost on carbon, which seems unlikely at present, much of the excess cost burden would remain because there are lower cost, low carbon alternatives available to meet the need for electricity. My analysis shows that even though all of the sunk costs must be paid due to the advanced cost recovery statutes, ratepayers would be better off if the ongoing projects are canceled and more cost-effective alternatives are pursued. The imprudence of continuing construction of these reactors was clear in 2009. Instead of asking for cost overruns year after year, as the utilities have been doing, they should have abandoned the projects. Unfortunately, guaranteed advanced cost recovery is too great an incentive, and regulation has been so weakened that imprudent choices cannot be resisted. While this is an important lesson for the states that rushed ahead, the really important lesson is for the other 47 states. Tearing the heart out of utility consumer protection to give incentives for nuclear reactor construction is a huge mistake that will inevitably impose a massive unnecessary burden on ratepayers and the state economy, and those 47 states had the good sense to resist that. I urge them to continue to do so. Thank you.
Okay, and again, that was Mark Cooper, the Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and the Environment, Vermont Law School, and author of the report, Public Risk, Private Profit, Ratepayer Cost, Utility Imprudence. That takes us on to our final speaker today, Peter A. Bradford.
Thank you. I want to draw on my background in state utility regulation to make just one point in supplementing the excellent work that Mark has done. That point is with regard to the rate-setting policy that's often referred to as advanced cost recovery. The claim that's made by ACR proponents that having customers pay for power plants years before they generate electricity somehow saves those customers money is completely false. In most cases, customers lose money under these rate-setting policies, which might more accurately be called advanced cost enhancement rather than advanced cost recovery. Only in a best-case scenario, which does not exist anywhere in the U.S. today, do customers have a chance of breaking even. They will never, absolutely never, come out ahead. Here's why. First, involuntary customer investment, which is what ACR really requires, does not reduce the cost of any element of the reactor. Steel, concrete, labor do not cost less. Nothing is cheaper, so costs can't go down. Second, since customers don't get dividends or interest on the capital that they're compelled to provide in advance, this capital seems cheaper and does appear to reduce the cost of the power plant. But what is really happening is that customers are taking risks normally borne by investors or lenders without being paid for those risks. So the costs are still there. They just don't show up in the cost of the power plant. Investors and lenders, by contrast, must be paid interest and dividends in return for bearing these risks, which include the possibility that the plant will be canceled or will operate poorly or will experience delays and cost overruns. To understand why customers take a bath under these arrangements, you need look no further than the recently canceled effort to increase the output of the Crystal River nuclear unit in Florida. Pursuant to Florida's law compelling customer investment, Crystal River customers advanced tens of millions of dollars to buy equipment and pay for construction. But the utility bungled the job so badly that the plant is now closed for good. Most of the money is gone. Refunds are unlikely. This is what I mean when I say that customers are taking large risks for which they are not being paid, a classic attribute of what Wall Street calls the dumb money. Third, as Mark has illustrated very well, reactor builders able to conscript capital from customers in advance while keeping the profits for themselves will naturally prefer to build nuclear plants even when other technologies, and especially energy efficiency, will be cheaper for their customers. And finally, one need only look at the preference of the large industrial customers who are sophisticated in matters of electricity finance and would be expected to endorse advanced cost recovery if they thought it really saved them money. But you won't find any endorsement of advanced cost recovery among this class of customers. Indeed, the Georgia legislature had to exempt industrial customers from paying advanced cost recovery in order to pass the legislation at all. In conclusion, advanced cost recovery is bad policy, both for the reasons that Mark has articulated and because it soaks consumers. The U.S. built the best electric system in the world without advanced cost recovery for most of the last century, and we ought to stick with that system going forward.
Okay, great. Thank you. And again, that was Peter A. Bradford, adjunct professor at the Vermont Law School and former member of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and former Utility Commission chair in New York and Maine. That's going to take us to the Q&A portion of today's call. I want to go ahead and invite the operator back on the line once more to explain to members of the news media how the Q&A period will go.
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star and then one on your touch-tone phone. If you would like to remove yourself from the queue, you may press star and then two. Again, it is star and then one to ask a question.
Okay, and while we're waiting on our first question, I want to emphasize that the Q&A period is for reporters only. You can find the new report that's being released today, as well as the related news release on the web at, and this is all lowercase, bit.ly/CooperACRReport. Again, this is all lowercase. It's bit.ly/CooperACRReport. And after the news event is over, you can go ahead and contact Will Harwood at 703-276-3255 to be connected with any of the speakers that you've heard from today. Operator, let's go ahead and move on to our first question.
Okay, the first question is from Ivan Penn at the Tampa Bay Times.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning.
Obviously, we've talked quite a bit on these various issues, but in this particular case, just wondering how you all would respond to the Florida, both legislative leaders as well as executive leadership, saying that, well, we just need to diversify and not rely on what now is becoming a huge dependence on natural gas.
Well, Ivan, as I testified twice in Florida, and the people I testified for are now litigating, the best way to diversify is to reduce demand. And so efficiency, which has a tremendous potential in Florida, needs to be considered as a means of diversification. Obviously, wind and solar are other alternatives that diversify. Using gas more efficiently through cogeneration also diversifies. And so if you do the count, if you do the analysis, you can end up with a more diverse mix by pursuing the set of alternatives that I talked about. Second of all, adding a big slug of nuclear power, well, it may diversify the mix, but it ties you to a resource that has proven to be troubling, to say the least. And obviously, the example of Crystal River is very fresh. So, nuclear power tends to be a resource that has a series of problems. New reactors don't always work so well. It takes years for them to work out the kinks. They require very large backup resources as opposed to the smaller approaches, and the more flexible approaches. So in a certain sense, nuclear is the antithesis of accomplishing what you want to accomplish by diversity. That is, it's big, it takes a long time, it tends to have potentially very big problems. If you want diversity, what you're talking about is you want to have flexibility. And so adding a bunch small resources that have short lead times, that don't require big commitments in terms of system resources, those get you the benefit of diversity that you really want.
This is Peter Bradford. I agree completely with what Mark has just said. Let me just add a couple of other thoughts. One way to diversify away from natural gas, if one wants to do it, is to run an auction for non-gas resources and see what you get and what their prices are. The problem in Florida is that the legislature not only decided it wanted this diversification, but then decided to handpick nuclear and favor it with this extremely generous and consumer onerous advanced cost recovery methodology. Second, though, with regard to gas, then the comparison to nuclear, yeah, it's true that gas prices have historically been volatile, but the logic that then says, and therefore we should substitute some nuclear, it doesn't really ring true when you consider that the gas volatility has basically been between prices that would result in kilowatt hours costing somewhere between 4 and 8 cents, whereas the lowest estimates for new nuclear are on the order of 12 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's not a sensible policy to pay 12 cents a kilowatt hour to avoid price volatility between 4 and 8 cents. It would be one thing to say, well, maybe we'd pay 7 for stability rather than jump around a lot between 4 and 8. But to pay 12 to insure against paying somewhere between 4 and 8 is economically ridiculous.
This is Mark Cooper again. Let me add one point to elaborate on something Peter said in a different respect. It turns out that if you look at the history of natural gas prices, volatility was very transitory. It was at brief moment in the right around the time people decided to think about nuclear that you had the volatility. It went away very quickly. So by 2009 and 10, natural gas prices had returned to their historical levels, which were fairly constant, moderately rising, but there was not a great deal of volatility. And if you look at the NYMEX today, I can go on the NYMEX and buy contracts out 10 years from now that show no volatility. And so the notion of natural gas is inherently volatile is actually contradicted by the historical evidence. That doesn't mean it can't be vulnerable, but the simple fact of the matter is the historical evidence does not support the claim that we should expect natural gas prices to be volatile. And in fact, with new technologies coming online, supplies coming online, the notion that it is going to be volatile loses credibility because the reserve-to-production ratio has been increasing in recent years. So not only shouldn't you pay too much to insulate yourself against gas volatility, it's not necessarily volatile, and you have other ways to insulate yourself that are less costly and less risky.
And just one other thing, what about small modular reactors?
Well, if you want to talk about uncertainty, there you have it. Small modular reactors are the classical part of the classic nuclear hype cycle. They're the holy grail, the unicorn that's just out of reach. And in a certain sense, shifting the attention to small modular reactors is the admission that what they sold me as the nuclear renaissance in the last 10 years was, in fact, a bill of goods, right? It wasn't a reality. It was a myth. Now they say, here, let's pursue the next myth. The simple fact of the matter is that the one person who should not be funding this type of gambling is the utility ratepayer. So, and in a certain sense in which advanced cost recovery is the cowardly thing for legislators to do. They basically say, well, we want to gamble some money, but we're unwilling to gamble with the money that we control, that is, the taxpayer money, And so what we do is they say, let's let the PUC gamble with ratepayer money. That is pure cowardice. And suggesting that ratepayers should fund small modular reactors simply takes that cowardly gamble and actually makes it even more risky, because here's a technology that no one has ever seen or knows how is going to work.
Yeah, keep in mind that when Florida's, and for that matter Georgia's and South Carolina's, advanced cost recovery statutes were passed in 2006, 2007, Mark's exactly right. The promise was that the nuclear renaissance would be based on standardized large reactor designs. It was going to be reactors from 1,000 megawatts on up to 1,600. The NRC was going to approve some generic designs. They would be stamped out like essentially a cookie cutter pattern. Many would be ordered and costs would come down. That model has fallen on its face, partially as a result of the increased cost estimates for the technology. So now there is this effort underway to substitute the next dream, which happens to be SMRs. And nobody knows whether anything's going to come of that or not, but it would be hard for them to cut the costs by enough to be competitive with today's alternative, somewhere between hard and impossible. And as Mark said, this is an old nuclear pattern. There's always a new technology, a new nuclear technology glimmering just over the horizon, if only we'll be patient and keep putting up enough money for long enough. And so far, no one of them has come in and delivered on the promise of costs too cheap to meter.
Okay, thank you.
Ivan, thank you for your question. Operator, let's go ahead and let's move on to our next.
All right, the next question comes from Julie Johnson from Bloomberg News.
Oh, hi, guys. Two real quick questions. First of all, I was wondering why the economic study only goes out 40 years and not 60 years, which is the anticipated lifespan of the new reactors. And secondly, I was just wondering what gas price, per MMBTU you used in your calculations.
Okay, well, the basic assumptions that I have used in this analysis, and I've reviewed two reactor projects very intensively, the Summer Project in South Carolina and the Levy Project in Florida.
Yeah.
I have relied entirely upon, as the base case, the numbers that the utilities have used. And so the 40-year life was the assumption that was used in the original need proceedings to get them authorized. They continue to be used in any update of the reactors. So that's their numbers now. The assumption about 60 years, given that a substantial number of reactors have not even done their 40-year life, I believe it's about 17%. Given the difficulties that we've now encountered with some renewals or extensions, a 60-year assumption would be a bit much. But let me also be clear that the way this analysis works is that generation technology with shorter lifespans, 25 or 30, which is the assumption used for natural gas, for instance, are renewed in the analysis process. So the capital costs of building the replacement plants to get you to 40 years are actually included. So
okay.
If you went out to 60, it would be, because these are discounted, deflated dollars. So these are net present value assumptions or analyses. The second point, the gas prices, the point of my paper is that what I've used for gas prices is the base case gas prices the utilities are using today. And they have gotten a lot closer to the economic reality. But the irony is that the interesting thing, certainly in the case of Summer, if you go back to 2008, when they did the initial gas price projection, they were way above the EIA's projection in 2008. And in Levy, they're also above, but not as much. So what has happened is that the original analyses were done with high gas price assumptions, very wide ranges of gas projections, and they've come way down. And one of the things I want to emphasize, and the way I said it in my statement today, and the way I write it in the paper, is that when a capitalist in a competitive market has to make a decision about whether to continue a project, which is what the utilities are supposed to be trying to, the regulatory commissions are supposed to be trying to emulate behave in that way. A, they don't look at the historic cost, the sunk cost, you're not allowed. But B, they have to look at the reality on the ground today, and they have to ask themselves, does this project continue to make sense on my going forward costs? And in this case, the reality on the ground today is that gas is cheap, and it would appear to continue to be cheap, at least in the estimates of the utilities and the EIA and the NYMEX. And on a going forward basis, we don't have a carbon tax today, which played a huge role in these decisions. We don't have a carbon tax today. We don't know when we'll have a carbon tax. We don't know how big it will be. And so the carbon tax assumptions were very important in decisions, and they proved to be wildly wrong. And so when you're looking out at the future today, you really do have to start from the base case reality of here. This is the way the world is today. Most of the world doesn't have a carbon tax. Most of the country doesn't have a carbon tax. Certainly Florida, South Carolina, and Georgia haven't enacted carbon taxes. Washington hasn't enacted a carbon tax. And so the reality on the ground today is that you need to start from this basic economic analysis, and then you can factor in, well, some of the what-ifs. And in this case, the what-ifs never make nuclear economic.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to figure out the base case, and I think it is important because we had, decade-low gas prices last year. I'm just trying to, is the projected savings from going with natural gas based on that, $2.80 or $3 per
No, the base case in each case tracks a little bit higher than NYMEX.
Okay.
A little bit higher than EIA. Now, NYMEX only goes out about 10 years.
Yeah.
And then EIA goes farther out. And so the base cases the utilities are using today are a lot closer to the EIA base case than they were in 08. So
okay.
If you go back to the EIA, and there's a graph that shows, in the document, shows in the case of summer, the EIA base case. So the summer calculation was slightly higher than the EIA base case. The Levy calculation was a little bit higher than that. But the utilities have been pulled back down to reality by the history. And if you look at the history, those few years of 08, 09, 07, 08, 09 were the exception rather than the rule.
Okay.
Julie,
right.
It's Peter Bradford. Just one other point. The years between the 40th year and the 60th year are of almost no importance in the kind of discounted present value approach that Mark describes, because even if you assumed immense benefits associated with a nuclear reactor in years 40 through 60, the effect of discounting, if you use any reasonable discount rate, is such that the value of a dollar in year 41, or even more, the value of a dollar in year 59, is just a couple of pennies. And so even if you extended the studies out through years 40 to 60 and discovered very large nuclear benefits, they wouldn't change a present value calculation done today by any significant amount.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Peter.
Okay, thanks for that question, Julie. Operator, let's go ahead. Let's move on to our next question.
The next question is from Matt Van Dyke at SNL Energy.
Hi. Two related questions. First, so are you all saying that there's no reasonable increase in gas prices down the road that would reverse this conclusion that it's cheaper to just eat the sunk costs of the of the reactors? And then same question, but with the carbon tax. I know that you said that, and I think almost everyone would agree with you, the carbon tax seems unlikely, but if there was one, could that reverse the conclusion that that the cheapest option is to just
Okay, so if you good question. So if you look at the South Carolina case, the utility took the position that if gas prices are 50% higher than the base case, and the carbon tax is $30 a ton and escalating, I think about 5% per year, then nuclear would be less costly. However, that assumption is based upon two other flaws in the analysis, which I point out in the paper. One, although the utilities have constantly had cost overruns, they don't model an excess of any further increases in nuclear costs. But they're unwilling to guarantee that. And so if you were to add 10 or 20% to the nuclear costs, even in that scenario, nuclear is more expensive. Second of all, they never look at the full range of alternatives. And so all of their analysis is done with nuclear versus gas, but efficiency is a lot cheaper than gas. And so if you and efficiency and gas are much more flexible. So rather than adding these massive increases in capacity at one time within a year or two, you could spread out your increments of power, have more flexibility. So the answer is, sure, you can hypothesize a scenario in which nuclear might be less costly. But that's a gamble that the utilities have been unwilling to take with stockholder money. And frankly, from the point of view of ratepayers, in these states, those ratepayers would be better off driving to Biloxi and playing the roulette table. They would have a better chance of winning at roulette than they would have of winning against that kind of gamble about the future. And one thing that utilities never show is the probability of any of these scenarios coming to pass. That's why you really need to keep the discipline of used and useful, just, reasonable, and prudent in place so that the people who are going to make the profit bear the risk rather than shifting it to ratepayers.
This is Peter Bradford. As to the imposition of a carbon tax, it's important also to keep in mind what that does primarily is not convey an advantage on nuclear. It conveys a disadvantage on fuels containing carbon. But there's no strong reason to believe that nuclear emerges a winner from a competition among the low-carbon alternatives either. First of all, with a carbon tax, you can get your carbon reductions anywhere in the economy. They don't have to come from the electric sector. So the competition includes vehicles, includes agriculture, includes space heating. It's also important to realize that the Exelon Corporation, which is the largest owner of nuclear power plants in the country, did a number of reviews of low-carbon alternatives in 2010, 2011, and in all of those, new nuclear was the second highest cost of all of the options that they saw. Their low-carbon plan going forward did not include new nuclear, even though it did include a goal of very substantial carbon reductions. I assume that's still on the Exelon website. If it's not, send me an email and I can send you the graphs that show very clearly that new nuclear doesn't win even in the case of quite a substantial carbon tax.
Peter, this is Mark Cooper again. Peter reminds me of another point, which I do make in the document and actually testified to in Florida. So when we approach the question of a carbon cost, whether it's a cap and trade or a tax, we have to ask the question, what is the program that it's going to be implemented? And what's clear, if we look at the only piece of carbon legislation that passed one of the houses of Congress, it included a very, very hefty amount of efficiency and renewable mandates. So it wasn't purely a carbon tax, and frankly, or a carbon cost, and everyone around the world is looking at the same thing. That is, the carbon policy we're going to see, if we ever get legislation, is going to have a great deal of directed technical change. And what happens when you mandate zero carbon things like efficiency in renewables, and efficiency certainly doesn't embody any carbon, whereas if you look at the products that are used to build nuclear reactors, they actually consume a lot of energy and probably emit a lot of carbon in their production, so you have to look at the cost of the materials. But the policy is going to mandate, at least, a very substantial reduction in demand for non-renewable generation capacity. In that environment, these reactors become huge problems of excess capacity. And it's very costly capacity, as Peter said, so you're not going to be able to sell it even in a low-carbon market, right? So one of the things I said is that if states want to begin to address carbon policy through their regulatory proceedings, they have to address the policy that looks like it might get enacted. And nuclear does not win in that scenario by any stretch of the imagination.
Thanks. And the point about the you compared it to roulette, is that just a? Are you just saying that as an analogy of how risky it is, or have you actually?
No. That's just a rhetorical point. It's basically the question is well. Okay, if we can hypothesize a set of circumstances in which consumers would win with this bet, then the question is, what's the probability that that circumstance will come to pass? And given the facts on the ground today, they wouldn't make this bet with stockholder money. They've made the bet with ratepayer money, and the reason they've done that is because it's not a very good bet. And so the roulette wheel is maybe colorful, but frankly, the odds on the roulette wheel are a lot better than the odds ratepayers face when they have to concoct these scenarios, unrealistic scenarios, in order to make the claim that they're doing what's good for the ratepayer.
Maybe it's worth saying, this is Peter Bradford again, for those of you who don't go back as far in utility rate making as Mark and I do, that the basic paradigm for building power plants for the whole of the last century was that the utilities used borrowed money and investor money to build whatever power plants they thought that they needed. Once the plant was built and turned on, just the way a paper mill or an oil refinery would do, that was the point in time at which they could begin to charge customers, and they charged them for the output of the plant. So what's fundamentally different about these laws is that they permit the utilities to start charging at the moment in time that the commission certifies that the plant is needed, which is turning out, the extreme case now is Florida, to be decades before there's any prospect of the plant being completed, and it may not be completed at all. So that's why the gamble on the customer's part is so large, and it's why it's so unnecessary. I mean, we built the world's best electric system without using this terribly investor-friendly, customer-hostile model of power plant finance.
Okay, well, Matt, thank you so much for your questions. And we want to make sure that everyone on the line has a chance to ask questions, so I'm going to go ahead and invite the operator back on once more to explain how the Q&A period will work.
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star and then 1 on your touchtone phone. If you would like to remove yourself from the queue, you may press star and then 2. Again, it is star and then 1 to ask a question.
Okay, great. And once again, I just wanted to stress that you can find all the materials related to this report and the press release on the web. Again, this is going to be all lowercase. It's bit.ly/CooperACRReport. And that's where we're also going to have a streaming audio replay of this news conference available as of 5 p.m. this evening. And we know that some reporters are going to want to go ahead and take their questions offline.
Once again, if you need to be connected with any of the speakers today, you can reach out to Will Harwood at 703-276-3255, and he can put you in touch. And at this point, let's go ahead and let's move back through the speakers that you've heard from today and offer a chance to give closing remarks on this report and news conference.
Well, this is Mark Cooper. The document is very long, and we've gone in great detail into the economics of how these imprudent decisions are being made. Both statutes are being litigated. We'll see. The legislature made a choice in 2006, 7, and 8 in these states. It has proven to be a very bad choice. The old system, as Peter suggested, worked just fine. And it's my hope to do two things. One, to convince other states they shouldn't tear the heart out of consumer protection in the utility sector. And two, these states that are wasting huge sums of consumer money should reconsider and see if they can find a way to step back from these bad decisions.
And this is Peter Bradford again. I'll just end where I began by reasserting that when you call the utility folks and ask them about this issue, they say, oh, well, the customers actually save money through these ACR statutes. They put their money up sooner, but in the long run, the plants cost less. It's just not true. If it were true, the industrial customers would be the first ones embracing it instead of the first ones rejecting it. To understand the risks involved and why it's not true, just look at Crystal River and the fact that all the money that the customers put up to increase the output of that plant is now, in all likelihood, a complete loss for them.
Okay, great. And as I said before, you can find this report and the related news release on the web. And at 5 o'clock this evening, we will have a streaming audio replay of this news conference available. That is all lowercase. It's bit.ly/CooperACRReport. If you need to be connected with either speaker that you heard from today, once again, you can reach out to Will Harwood at 703-276-3255. And once again, you've been listening to a news conference sponsored by the Vermont Law School Institute for Energy and the Environment. Thank you so much for joining us today. That concludes today's news event.